Welcome to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers' Fest. The Vancouver Writers' Fest connects people to exceptional books, ideas, and dialogue through year-round programming that ignites a passion for words and the world around us. I'm Leslie Hertig, Artistic Director, and I'm very happy to share this conversation featuring former Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin in conversation with CBC journalist Laura Lynch. This event was recorded live on October 27, 2019 at the Granville Island Stage in Vancouver. Special thanks to our event sponsors, Tourism Vancouver and Southern Butler Price. This event features Beverly McLaughlin speaking about her new book, Truth Be Told, My Journey Through Life and the Law.
Hello, everybody. Oh, wow, I'm glad you're all here. It's a full house. Fantastic. I don't know if you saw my tweet earlier today, but I feel so lucky because I get to talk to Beverly McLaughlin not once, but twice. I told her that when we finished the interview on The Current several weeks ago that we're taking our show on the road. So we are doing that tonight, and I just want to say a few words about Beverly McLaughlin before we get started. This is also thrilling for me for other reasons, because I am a Vancouver native, born and bred. I went to law school. I articled. I seriously contemplated a life in the law, and I saw this woman rocketing up through the profession like no other woman I had seen do before, and she's been an inspiration to me before, during, and since. So I'm thrilled to be here with you. Beverly McLaughlin, you may or may not know, grew up in a log house in Pincher Creek, Alberta. And she was almost driven mad by the isolation of life in rural Canada. It's strange to think that she might have been seen as a country girl of no consequence at that time. She was told by her grade 8 teacher she had no employable skills. And she grew up, as you know, to become the first female Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, though it took some convincing for her to give law a shot in the first place. Her book, which she has here, is Truth Be Told, Through Life and Law, and it is her account of her unlikely and extraordinary rise. And she is going to talk to us about it tonight. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Good. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you here in Vancouver. It's lovely to be back.
Yeah, it is nice to be back. I'm going to start the same way I started when I spoke to you several weeks ago, because I think people would be interested in this. You're the first Chief Justice to write an autobiography. Mm-hmm. Why did you go ahead and do this?
It's a long story, but I had always thought I would not do it. I mean, people had said in the last years of my time on the court, well, you know, you should write something, or journalists have come and said, we'd like to be your ghostwriter, And I always said, no, I wasn't interested. And I remembered a story that I'd heard when I first came to the Supreme Court of Canada about a judge before me who had been asked to write his autobiography. And he said, let me think about it for the weekend. So he came back on Monday and he said, the answer is no. Living it once was enough. And I thought there was a lot of wisdom in that. and also, you know, if you read the book, you probably don't believe this, but I am a fairly private person, and I felt that if I was going to do it, you'd have to do it all, good and bad, and I didn't really want to open that up. But when I had retired, my publisher, but a lot of people too, said, you know, you've been fortunate to have an amazing story and a life different from anybody else, as any other woman who has ever come before you. And there's so many people struggling to try to get ahead and wondering if they can make it, and your story could help them. And I thought about that, and I thought, yeah, some good might come of it, so I decided to write it.
You think some good's come of it?
I think so. A lot of... I hope so. A lot of people have told me that they've enjoyed reading it. They've learned a lot about different things. But people have told me that young women have come and said, you know, you know, it really encouraged me to hang in there, stick through the tough times, because there were tough times, many of them, and just pursue my dream and not give up.
Let's go back to what I mentioned in the introduction, your grade 8 teacher telling you you had no employable skills.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that.
Yeah. Well, she was probably right at the time. I was I was a pretty mixed up kid inside anyway. But we had no school counselor, and in our little country high school, small town high school. And I... But they did give us a test in grade 8, which was supposed to suss out what we'd be good at and not, to help us along life's road. And so when the test results came back, you had to go up to the front of the class, and the teacher in whispered voices would sort of tell you, and all your classmates are sitting at the back, you know, wondering what you're getting. And so when my turn came, she looked at me and she said, she looked at the score and she said, "I don't know what to tell you," she says. And she said, "You have a phenomenal reading retention score," she said, "but that won't do you any good as a girl." And she said, "On the other hand," she said, "you have one of the lowest alertness levels we've ever seen." And most of the women's jobs involved alertness, like, you know, even high school teaching or whatever, nursing, secretary. I mean, you have to pay attention to the details. And so she was really puzzled. She said, "Well," she was trying to be helpful. She said, I will tell you this. There are two things you must never be: a waitress or a telephone operator." So, only the law was left, I guess.
Thank goodness for that. When did you first start thinking about law as a profession?
Well, it was when I was about 22, and I had been going to university and studying philosophy, and I had thought my plan was to go to graduate school and become a university professor in philosophy department somewhere. But I was getting a little disenchanted with the current state of philosophy. I still love philosophy, and it's been hugely important throughout my life, even as a judge. But at the time, it was all tied up with linguistic philosophy and semantics and trying to turn words and ideas into algebra, which was definitely not my thing. And so I was dithering a bit, and my friend, whom I later married, Rory McLaughlin, said to me out of the blue, "Why don't you go to law school?" And I had never thought about that, because for me, the law was, first of all, something I'd never had no role models. I didn't know any lawyers except our little town lawyer, Garth Turcotte.
And you didn't know any lawyers, or you didn't know any female lawyers?
I didn't know any lawyers. And I knew there were no female lawyers. There couldn't be, or I would have heard about it. And I had some vague awareness that there was a law school on top of the Rutherford Library at the University of Alberta, and that men went in and out all the time and up to the third floor, but I'd never seen a woman do that, and because I would go there to study on the second floor. And so... in philosophy, at least, you know, as a woman, you really felt equal. But I thought, why would I want to go into that, where I don't even know a single woman who has ever succeeded at it? But in the end, I did. But it came about in a funny way, which I was dithering about whether to go to graduate school in the late autumn the late summer, and I wrote a letter entitled, "Dean, Law School, could you give me some information?" So I deposited that in the little post office at Pincher Creek, and it came back 4 days later with a very slim envelope, and I thought, oh, he's going to say it's too late. And it was Dean Bowker, who is a legendary figure, married to a wonderful lawyer named, whom I didn't know about because she'd never practiced, And he said, "You're accepted." So when the time came, I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And I've been in the law ever since.
How many women were in your class?
I think there were around six or seven, something like that. And when we started off, I think it was a little bit of falling by the wayside throughout the years. But we had quite a large cohort for that time. It was the largest cohort of women there'd ever been. And people really were starting to wonder what was going to happen to the world with all these women lawyers. Four or five out of a class of 65, can you imagine? But it still was very much a man's world.
I know that you've prepared a couple of readings for us. Would you like to do your first
reading?
Well,
we've touched on some of them, but I'll duplicate. I'm starting off. I start off with my earliest recollections, and as you said, things were very simple. We didn't have electricity or running water, and everyone had to pull their own weight. But as a child, my impressions, and I was interested, there was no kindergarten, no kind of preschool education. My mother and father were really, really busy. And so I was the eldest child, and I was just starting to wonder about ideas in the world. So I write this: "I recall as a five-year-old thinking about numbers. I found my mother frantically sweeping some mess off the kitchen floor. 'How long would it take to count to 100? I asked. She brushed me away. I persisted. 5 minutes? Brush, brush, brush. 10 minutes? Brush, 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 brush. An hour? Yes, she said in exasperation with a swish of the broom that shoved me out the door. I must have looked disappointed. An hour in my child's mind was an enormous stretch of time. Mom paused in her sweeping. 'You'll soon go to school,' she said. 'They'll teach you everything you need to know.' Her face softened, and she launched into her own memories of her one-room prairie school. 'I loved school,' she said. 'It was the best time of my life. But I had to leave before I finished.' Her voice trailed off. 'The rest is history.' 'They'll teach you everything you need to know.' The phrase preoccupied me. What did I, a girl, need to know? Not much, I thought, looking at my mother. How to cook, clean, shop, and look after the kids. But there was a wistfulness in those other words she spoke. I was too young to realize what my mother had given up just because she had made the choices expected of a girl. But the germ of a query fixed itself in my juvenile brain. Could there be more than what girls were expected to do? Other dreams? Other possibilities? I was too young to fully articulate the question, much less answer it. But it would never let me go." And then I'll read again the story we just went through about my grade eight. So I went to school in a small public school in Pincher Creek, Alberta, where I came from, and there's a lot about that town in the book, which turned out to be a wonderful place to grow up, partly because of the library. But it, notwithstanding, it was a very rural area. The ranchers and farmers were the backbone of the community. People had good values. People expected people to behave in a moral and authentic way and to work and pull their own weight in the community. And as I say in the book, it is not just my family that raised me, but it was the community that brought me up. I had 1 year when we were moved to a very remote ranch when I had to do correspondence. And I found that very difficult. And as you've touched on, I decided that I would go to school. So there I was in grade eight, back at school, but very confused and somewhat unhappy. And I say this: I slid through the school year in a haze of academic indifference. Having longed achingly the year before for a real school, I now convinced myself that correspondence and books had already taught me everything the teachers were trying to convey. Apart from a brief passion for Napoleon and his lightning conquest of Europe, I have no recollection of what I learned in grade 8. And so it didn't come as a surprise to hear that my teachers entertained a low opinion of my future prospects. Our school had no counselor and no career guidance program, but all grade 8 students were given a series of tests designed to suss out what they might be good at. When the test results came back, the homeroom teacher took me aside to explain them and offer advice. I perched myself on the edge of a chair she had placed beside her desk. She pulled a sheet of paper from the pile before her and studied it, then peered at me over half-moon glasses. "I don't know what to tell you," she said. I sat silent. "Well," the teacher said, holding my test results under her right palm, "you have an extremely high reading retention score, but that won't do you much good." She paused. "As a girl, you know." She ran her finger down the lines of print. "You also have the lowest alertness score I've ever seen." She shook her head in a flurry of tight gray curls, searching for a piece of useful advice. "One thing I can tell you, you must never be a waitress or a telephone operator." She pushed my paper aside and pulled the next one from the pile. "That's all. Please ask Jimmy to come up." And then my introduction to law school. The story again that we've already touched on. In the dying days of August, I wrote a letter to the dean of the Faculty of Law at the University of Alberta. I knew there was a Faculty of Law and assumed there must be a dean. "Dear Dean," I wrote, "I would appreciate information about the study of law." I licked the envelope, stamped the letter, and dropped it in the mail slot at the tiny Pincher Creek post office, then drove to the co-op to get the provisions I'd been sent to town to fetch. 4 days later, I once again found myself in the foyer of the post office, picking up the mail. Riffling through the usual pile of bills, I stopped at a white envelope with the return address, Office of the Dean of Law. I frowned. I'd expected a big envelope filled with brochures and information. Maybe it was too late to apply for this year. I tore open the envelope, unfolded the letter, and stared at the simple message. "Thank you for your inquiry. I am delighted to advise that you are admitted to first-year studies in the Faculty of Law. Yours truly, Wilbur Bowker, Dean." I reread the letter, dumbfounded. Even in those simple pre-LSAT days, there were procedures to be followed. You weren't simply admitted to law school without ever having applied. Yet here was a dean in a discipline devoted to proper prerequisites and procedures, cutting through them all and simply saying, "You are admitted." And that indeed was a life-changing moment. So as I said earlier, I decided to try, and instead of going off to graduate school in some exotic place, on September 13, 1965, I once again boarded the Greyhound bus to the University of Alberta. I felt a sense of wrongness as I slid into the grungy seat. For years, I had looked forward to this as the moment when I would spread my wings and fly to far-off places. But here I was, making the long trip back to the same old city, the same old campus, headed north, but going backwards fast. All to take on the law, a strange profession that, as far as I could tell, promised only disappointment for the few women who dared enter it. I opened my purse and fingered the offers from far-flung universities, my backup plan still intact. And that is how I got to law school.
Shame it didn't work out.
Well, once I got there, I realized I loved the law, and I found my having studied philosophy, it was like applied philosophy, mm-hmm. and it was a lovely mixture of concepts, moral philosophy, intellectual rigor and developing arguments and so on. And also, it was dealing with real life and real life situations, which was wonderful.
So you graduated in 1968.
Yes.
And what was it like for a woman trying to enter the profession, to be part of the profession then in Canada?
Well, it was, to say the least, somewhat difficult. I was fortunate that I graduated at the top of my class, so I thought, well, somebody will hire me. And there had been a few women sprinkling. There was one or two women in the class before me, and they had found jobs. So I thought, well, things will go well. So I went for my first articling interview and with a fine firm, and I knew the gentleman who was interviewing me because he had been one of my teachers. And we had a wonderful interview. I thought everything is going great. And then just as it was terminating, he stunned me. He said, "Why do you want to work?" And I just didn't know how to answer that. I didn't have the context, which I learned about later, which was that married women were not to work, and they never did in the law. And I had been married, married Rory the previous summer. So he said, "Well, you're married, aren't you?" He saw I was flabbergasted. And I don't even remember what happened. I just fled, I think. I must have said something. And then I got a position at the second place I interviewed, and in the same building. And they were a wonderful firm. And after I'd been there for a few days, I told someone about this incident, and he laughed, and he said, "Well, you know, the tradition is that married women don't work. We had a woman working here for a number of years, but she decided to get married rather late in life, but she gave up her practice, and that's what people expect. But it's changing," he said. And I had been totally oblivious to that because I came from a little community where women worked. They did everything that the men did, including baling hay. So I had never come up with this. I'd never confronted this strange notion that when you were married in the 50s and in the 60s, you were, and before that, it was somehow immoral for you to work outside the home.
You shared an office with another woman?
Yeah, so then the firm I went to, who treated me very, very well, but, you know, it's this kind of unconscious discrimination and bias that has always been there. People say, "Oh, well, of course, we're really progressive. We've hired women, and everybody's treated equally." But what happened? The woman, Nina Foster, who had graduated the year before me, had just been called to the bar. So they informed her and informed me that as an articled student, I would go and share her office. Well, I'm sure she didn't like it very much, but she didn't do anything, and we became quite good friends. And then in a year's time, I was called to the bar and asked to stay on at the firm. And I think we both thought things would change because every lawyer had his own office. And there I came back from my swearing-in ceremony and nobody'd moved my desk and I was still there. So next morning I came to work and Nina's desk was bare. And I went out to do something in the library. I came back and Nina was walking down the hall with her arms carrying a box full of files. And she just huffed by and disappeared around the corner. And I went in and I realized what had happened. So I said, a little while later, the managing partner came to see me. He said, "Where's Nina?" And I said, I think she's left." "Well, why would she leave?" "Well, I think she thinks she should have her own office." And he looked very mystified. And then he went out. I could hear the doors clicking all the way down the hall as he... And finally he came back and he said, "Well, where is she?" And I said, "I don't know." He said, "Well, we think she's in the washroom." So he said, "Go and get her." And so I said, "Okay." And I went in and Nina was... a great smoker, and she was standing there in her camel hair suit, and she was blowing rings of blue smoke up toward the ceiling exhaust, leaning against the counter where the sinks were. And I said something like, I said, Nina, they'd like to talk to you. She just blew another ring of smoke. And I said, I think you'll get your office. So very grudgingly, she put out her cigarette and she went back. And she got her office and I got one too. But that was, everybody was mystified about this. Why would we not want to share an office? It'd be nice for us, right? Company.
I've been in the Chief Justice's office in Ottawa. It's really nice and big. I just want to go ahead, take a few leaps ahead here. You eventually end up moving to Vancouver. You are teaching at UBC Law School. And in 1985, you're appointed to the BC Court of Appeals, the highest court in BC. Mm-hmm. And you say that's when you really began to feel the weight that comes with being a first.
Well, there was there'd always been people before me. Pat Proudfoot, bless her memory. It was a lovely obituary just a couple of days ago in the Globe and Mail.
Yeah, she was a BC Supreme Court.
She was a wonderful
first woman.
Yeah,
in the BCs.
Not on the Court of Appeal, I think. The obituary said that, but she was certainly before me on the County Court and on the Supreme Court. And I think so I always felt at least she was there. And there were a few other women being appointed to the county court at that time, and so it's still pretty lonely as a woman. But when I got to the Court of Appeal, I was the only woman there at that time, and not that I was. Everyone welcomed me, and Nathan Nemetz, the Chief Justice, was very helpful, and I was really, really well treated, but. I realized that when you're the first woman to take on something, as Pat Proudfoot before me had been, there's a special kind of scrutiny that you receive and from the outside world and so on. And you feel an extra sense that you have to do a good job. Not that I'd ever done anything but my best, I think, but you do feel that extra weight. A little bit of being the first, so I learned a new respect for people like Pat Proudfoot, who were the real trailblazers. Nobody had come before them. No women had come before them.
And then 3 years later, Brian Mulroney calls you up and asks you to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of BC, and
yes.
you actually said no.
Well, I did. It was a very difficult time in my life because. My husband was dying, and I had a young son, and we had a young son, and I knew that this would be a very heavy job, and really I just couldn't contemplate. I couldn't think about it because I was so emotionally involved in this process that was what was happening with him dying, And I just said to the Prime Minister, I said, this is not the right time. I can't even think about this, and I don't think it's the right time for me in any event. And I was very dismissive. And then Brian Mulroney, being who he is, he kept calling back every day, and about 2 o'clock, which would be 5 o'clock in Ottawa, I would get a call. And I had my office next to the bedroom where my husband was. And finally he asked, my husband asked, who's been calling? And I said, the Prime Minister. He must have thought I had lost it, but he didn't. And he said, what does he want? He was very, very ill at this time, and a lot of the time in and out, but he was lucid at that moment. And I said, he wants me to take on the Chief Justice of the trial of Supreme Court. And I told him I couldn't even consider it now. And there was a long pause, and then he said, you should do it. And so I did it.
You did.
Not for long, though. 8 months later, Brian Mulroney called me again and said he wanted me to go to Ottawa. So I said, okay. I knew what I was up against.
8 months, and then you're sworn in. And I love this. Justice Bertha Wilson, who was the first woman to be named Supreme Court of Canada, she said something to you.
Yeah, well, maybe I should read at this point because I was going to go to that place next.
This is all organic. Perfect. Yeah. Would you like to read some more?
Yeah. I find my place now. Okay. On Monday, April 17th, 1989, before a packed courtroom, I was sworn in as the 65th Queenie Judge of the Supreme Court of Canada. My voice trembled with emotion as I repeated the oath in French and English. I walked to the desk, took the pen, and signed. The deed was done. I mounted the stair, took my place at the end of the bench, and looked down the long, curved plane of wood. 8 judges, 6 male, 2 female. My eye halted at Claire-Laure Dubay, dark-haired and smiling, at the other end of the dais. And then moved back to Bertha Wilson, the first woman to be appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada. Bertha returned my look and leaned forward. She had a lovely Scottish accent. 3 down, 6 to go, she whispered. Speeches followed. The Minister of Justice and representatives of the bar took their turns, struggling to find something auspicious to say. I had been a judge for only 8 years. I was a decent judge, they said. I wrote clear reasons. The treasurer of the Law Society of British Columbia, Paul Beckman, decided to forego the bromides. The new justice, he intoned dryly, is noted for 2 things. First, it was evident looking at her career that she couldn't keep a job. Second, she has made it through the court system faster than most cases. So I say his remarks brought the house down. I talk about Brian Dixon, a jurist I'd long revered, welcoming me and a dinner we had that night. And continuing on Bertha's story, or Bertha's line, a few weeks later I flew to Edmonton to speak at a legal conference. I was not a seasoned orator. I had done very little public speaking in Vancouver and consulted some of my new colleagues on how to go about it. Say something funny at the beginning, they advised, something that will make them chuckle. Then you can get on with the serious stuff. After I was introduced as the recently appointed third woman on the Supreme Court of Canada, I stood up and launched into my opening story. Let me tell you what Justice Wilson said when I took my place on the bench after signing the oath. I said, 3 down, 6 to go. I even rolled my R's. A few people laughed, and I got on with the serious stuff. I thought nothing more of it until the next morning when someone brought me the Edmonton Journal. There at the top of the op-ed page was a letter from an irate citizen. How dare the new justice suggest the Supreme Court of Canada should be composed entirely of women? The writer fulminated. Judges wisely let disparaging comments, and I've had a lot in my day, lie and decline to reply to criticism, however unfair it may be. But had I been allowed to respond, I would have pointed out that for more than a century, the Supreme Court of Canada was composed entirely of men and had somehow survived. Was it so outrageous to think the court might survive 9 women for a while? More seriously, I would have argued that it is important to have both men and women on Canadian courts, both to provide female perspectives on legal problems and to reassure women that they are fairly represented.
I want to talk now about something that you write about in the book, and it is just so compelling and somewhat difficult to read. And this is about your own personal struggle when you were hearing the case of Rodriguez mm-hmm. versus British Columbia. Sue mm-hmm. Rodriguez, I'm sure most of you remember, was a woman from Vancouver Island who had ALS. She was seeking an assisted suicide, and it was illegal back then. but you were wrestling with something personal when you sat on that case.
Well, I had just a couple of years before been through the death of my husband, and toward the end, he was suffering very badly, and at one point he asked me whether I could help him and end his life, and I couldn't bring myself to do it, so I had that in my background. I knew the suffering that people went through at the end of their life, very intimately sometimes, and I knew how important it was to individuals to control the end of their life as well as everything that had gone before, and to retain dignity to the end. So I felt very deeply emotional about this case, and I went to see the Chief Justice, and I said, you know, I have an open mind. In fact, I don't know what I would rule at this point, but I do have my own experience. And he said, well, that you should say it. He said, judges are human beings, and the reason we appoint human beings and don't just let robots do it is so they can bring their experiences. And so I did, and it was a difficult case for me to hear. And in the end, this was 1993, I believe, in the end, the majority of the court, it was a split decision, very close, 5-4, but the majority held that the provision in the criminal code that made it an offense to assist a person in committing suicide, that was constitutional. And I wrote the leading dissent arguing that to deny a person assistance when they clearly and demonstrably, and safeguards have to be in place, of course, wanted to end their life early, that that was a denial of liberty and that it wasn't justified. So that was the case, and as everybody knows, just shortly before I stepped down from the court, we heard another British Columbia case, the Carter case, and the court, based on this time a very fulsome record, which was full of evidence about precautions, how other countries had managed, and what were the consequences, and so on. Justice Lynn Smith wrote a very detailed and careful judgment here in British Columbia. And the court unanimously reversed the Rodriguez case. Now, precedent is very important in our law and in the Supreme Court. And so the biggest hurdle was can you reverse a previous precedent like Rodriguez? But we reasoned that with the state of science and understanding having changed, and with the very fulsome and very different record that we had before us, the court was in a position and justified in coming to a different conclusion. And so the Carter decision was ended.
I may be mistaken, but I think that in the second ruling, in the Carter ruling, they largely picked up on your dissent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, see, she's modest, she's not saying that.
It was by the court, but yeah.
What was that moment like for you when the ruling changed?
Well, I thought it was good for justice. I mean, I didn't feel any sense of elation or anything, but one of the great satisfactions that I've had in my life is from time to time, as a judge, having the opportunity to develop the law or answer legal questions in a way that makes life easier for people and makes life better for people. Same-sex, LGBTQ rights fall into that category. There are. It gives me great satisfaction. I'm sure it does all of the judges who sat on those cases, and to know that the law can actually work to change people's lives for the better, and that our law in Canada is indeed a living tree, as Viscount Sankey described in his metaphor in the person's case, and that it can grow and change and develop as society's mores change.
And that's been more so with the advent of the Charter. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about how the role of the court has changed since Charter rulings began to reshape Canadian society.
Well, the Charter really made a huge change in what judges had to do, because judges had always, in Canada, federally appointed judges, Supreme Court of Canada, had always been constitutional judges in the sense that they had to decide federalist issues, provincial powers, federal powers, conflicts of that sort. But by and large, the judges had never had to wade into big moral issues or issues of rights and so on. The Diefenbaker Bill of Rights Court had taken a very conservative approach. So suddenly here you had a constitutional Bill of Rights, which meant that all government action and all laws had to conform to those rights and respect those rights. And who was going to decide when there was a challenge, when a citizen went to court and stood up and said, this law infringes my right or this government action infringes my right? Everybody knew it was going to be the courts. So there was a lot of debate about that as the Charter was being drafted and adopted in that process, and that's why we got Section 33, the notwithstanding clause. The people who feared too much judicial power said the legislature or parliament has to have the last word if they feel the judges have gone astray. But anyway, I came to the bench in 81 and the Charter came in 82, so my whole career was kind of shaped by the Charter. And it was a whole new role, first of all, to interpret all those brand new shiny rights and freedoms that everybody was told they had constitutionally right to. And secondly, then to apply them and find the remedies and make the whole thing work. And it was a hugely challenging juristic task, and most of the initial work fell on the Supreme Court of Canada because they were the final, and so I was a judge in BC and I would watch these decisions come down. It became quite apparent fairly early on. Another BC case. BC has made most of this law, and
it's true,
I don't know what it is in the water out here, but
yeah.
You guys like to litigate. We like to litigate. Anyway, and take these questions to the farthest and the highest court. And so it became apparent that in the motor vehicle reference, which came from this province, that certain other cases, that the court was going to take a very broad and purposive approach to the Charter and really give these rights teeth, and that they meant something and the message was clear. This changed things very much for judges. And then people started to complain about judicial activism because laws would fall. The Charter says to the extent that a law is inconsistent with the Charter, it's null and void. So it's not like the judge goes out and says, I'm going to strike down that law. But if the judge says it's inconsistent, the law falls. And so there was a lot of angst and anxiety and writing in newspapers for a decade or so, and just still occasionally surfaces, that this had all been a terrible mistake, and the judges were taking hold of the agenda, and Parliament was going to be rendered powerless. Of course, I would argue none of that has happened. Generally, if a law is parts of a law are null and void because they conflict with the Charter, usually the matter goes back, and Parliament or the legislature can deal with it. And if not, there's probably a good reason why they shouldn't. And the public, I think, has become aware that judges try to act very deferentially and carefully when they're in this area, and they just don't go on a slash and burn technique to exercise to change the laws that Parliament or the legislature in its wisdom has adopted. But it's more like a pruning, I think, than a slash and burn exercise.
There's one area, you heard cases throughout the years that challenged sexual assault law, and you wrote decisions, mm-hmm. particularly one that mm-hmm. women or activists, women in general, did not like. Yeah. You were pilloried for that. Tell me about making those decisions that you knew would be bring down the wrath of feminist
critics. Well, I think that's why judges have independence. You know, you have to, I always told myself, you have to do the right thing. The thing that you're convinced in your conscience and by the record and the arguments, and after serious thought, what is right. In this case, it was the Seaboard case, and there was an argument that the total ban on any questioning of prior sexual conduct by a complainant could, in certain very rare circumstances, deprive the person accused of another charter right, his charter right or to a fair trial. And so the court, in a very careful judgment, which I wrote, and some people say, why did you write it? But anyway, we said, yes, to this extent, the law should be changed to allow for a defense in rare and occasional cases. And then we set out guidelines, et cetera. So it was, I thought, a pretty conservative piece of work. But I think the... But it did bring down the wrath of particularly many, many, many feminists, many women who thought that I'd betrayed the cause. But it didn't really bother me that much because, as I say, that your job as a judge requires you sometimes to make decisions you know are going to be unpopular, and you do your best, and you're not a politician. You're not put in that place to simply change the law the way you personally would like to see it changed. You have to pay attention to the law and all the other countervailing considerations that are brought forward. In the end, it turned out all right, I think, because Parliament took it up. They crafted a slightly different law that allowed all the protections plus a defense in these rare cases. And that law came, was challenged, it passed scrutiny, and I think it's worked out fine. But at the time, it was quite a furor. But as I say, as a judge, you have to have the courage to make the decision that you think is the right decision and take whatever flack comes.
You say you weren't a politician, but you had to deal with politicians. You may know what's coming next.
Yeah.
There's this great picture of you in the book with Jean Chrétien and Brian Mulroney and Justin Trudeau all looking very happy mm-hmm. together. But there's somebody missing. you were Chief Justice during the Stephen Harper years, and you had a pretty public dust-up with him in 2013.
Yeah.
What did he accuse you of doing?
Well, I woke up one morning. I was in New Brunswick giving a speech the night before. It was about 4 in the morning, and I just looked at the Globe and Mail. I was sitting on the counter as I was checking out, and there was a headline saying that the Prime Minister was accusing me of misconduct in interfering with the appointment of Justice Nadon, who had been appointed, and then that had given rise to a reference, or rather a lawsuit challenging him, and in the end, it's all very complicated and it would take too long to get into all the details, but under the law, Quebec is entitled to 3 judges, and they have to become from a member of the bar or a court in Quebec, and that's a Supreme Court act. And so the question was whether Justice Nadon is a federal court judge who hadn't lived in Quebec for a very long time and wasn't a judge of a court in Quebec and hadn't practiced there for more than 20 years, whether he fulfilled that requirement. And the court said no. And... any event, that was the Nadon business, and in the meantime, we had sworn in Justice Nadon and welcomed him to the court. But the Prime Minister made this accusation based on the fact that some months before Nadon's name ever came up, I had heard that maybe they were thinking about somebody from the federal court to fill a Quebec position. And so one of the things a Chief Justice has to do is talk to the Justice Minister sometimes about appointments, because this is part of the administrative work. So I'd been told that by Quebec people who were alarmed that this might give rise to litigation. So I phoned the Justice Minister and I told him that I'd heard this and I thought he might like to consider it. That was the end of it, and I never had any further conversations.
That was several months before.
And that was months before Nadon's name ever came out. So, I mean, I was pretty shocked, and I went back and I issued a...
You must have been furious.
Yeah.
He was calling your reputation into question.
Well, I know. And if he'd been right, I would have stepped down. I mean, I you can't have a Chief Justice who's, I don't believe, has misconducted herself. It wouldn't be good for justice. So it was very serious. I went back. I looked at my file. I issued a statement saying, I've done nothing wrong. These are the facts. And I set out all the date lines. And over to you. If you can say that's wrong, fine. If you can show I got my facts wrong, fine. But the Canadian public is entitled to know precisely what happened. And I left it at that. I didn't make any arguments. And in due course, the International Bar Justice Associations and other groups all came forward and said this was nonsense, that I hadn't done anything wrong. But it was a trying period.
I think you're minimizing again. It must have been. Why? What do you think brought that on?
I can't speculate. I refuse to speculate. But
darn.
Sorry.
It's worth a try. But then you got a new dog.
Yeah.
Yes. And
so I don't know, maybe I could read that.
Oh, it's really good. Yeah.
I'll have to find it here. Sorry,
It's worth the wait.
I was told 5 minutes to for this.
Well, this is an extra reading, but it's a really good one. I want to hear.
Yeah. You think I'd know what I wrote, eh? Where it is.
I know you know the story.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll just tell it. So anyway, I'm in these dark days, I was sitting down in my basement office preparing for the case next day, and I got a call from my dear friend Warren Winkler, who had been, just until very recently before that, the Chief Justice of Ontario. And he also came from Pincher Creek, so we were kind of friends.
Something's in the water there.
A lot of judges come from Pincher Creek. And four Chief Justices, in fact, over history. But anyway, so you have to bear with me while I give you the context. Wink, as I called him, raised black lab dogs, and he had some very good ones, and he had one particular one called Gretzky. I had always had black lab dogs, but my most recent one, Kiri, had died. And so Wink had said to me, well, if I ever get a really good one from Gretzky, I'll let you know. And years went by, and then I get this call on this night and in my basement office. And he rambles around, and he says, well, you know, I've got a great litter. This kennel has a great litter, and they're descended from Gretzky, and there's 8 little black lab pups, and they're just absolutely marvelous. And I knew where he was going. I said, I don't think this is the right time for us. I said, you know, Frank and I have talked about it, and our lives are so busy, and we're not sure we can take on training a new dog. And he said, oh, I understand. So we had a nice conversation. He hung up. About 20 minutes later, he calls back and he says...
Sounds like Brian Mulroney.
Yeah. And he says, well, you know, I just spoke to the kennel owner and all the dogs are taken, but there's one that the RCMP hasn't yet made the final claim on for as a police dog. And you might be able to get that dog. And I said, I don't think so. Anyway, I went back up, and my husband, who had been adamantly against getting another dog, he was watching the 9 o'clock news, and he said, who's calling? I said, Wink. And what is he? Well, I told him. And I said, he has a puppy he'd like us to take. Frank looked at me, and he said, take it. And that was so sweet and unselfish of him, because he knew I needed something new and
unconditional
wonderful
love.
And yeah. Unconditional love in my life. So we picked up this little dog in May while some of this fur was still going on, and he reached up and licked my face, and I felt all wet, and it wasn't just the little puppy, and he still is our most amazing, amazing dog. But anyway, the question came, what was I going to call him? So in a moment of frivolity, I suppose you could say, I said, I think I should call him Harper. I could say Harper sit. Harper lie down. And you know, I actually liked the name. And it seemed like a good idea. And then I thought about going down. Ottawa's a very political place. Going down to the dog park, you know. All the politicians and civil servants there with their dogs. And I thought they might misunderstand. So we named the dog Darcy from Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. And I again like to say, I said, well, he's dark and handsome and the folly of my old age. So,
so have you heard from the other Harper since the book came out? You
told we see each other once in a while in airports or some function. And we're very polite and had some great conversations. This business is never alluded to. But I don't know if he's read the story, though.
Such a great story.
But I meant it in great faith. I mean, I've always been very nonpartisan, and I think our prime ministers take on an enormous load. And you know, I have nothing against Mr. Harper at all. I like him, actually. I didn't like the fact that he thought I'd done something wrong, but I have the greatest respect for all of our prime ministers.
We were talking earlier about what Bertha Wilson said to you when you were appointed to the court, and this idea of more women. And now there's a different conversation today about the composition of the court. And I'm wondering whether you think it's reflective enough of Canadian society.
The short answer is obviously no. We need to have more diversity, and I think it'll come. We'll have Indigenous people on the court, we'll have people of different racial backgrounds. If you look at our courts, federal court system, these people are more and more, and that's the seed ground for the Supreme Court. So I think it's just a matter of time. Unfortunately, you know, or fortunately, I'm not criticizing the system, but we all know, a lot of lawyers in this room, that it takes to be qualified to be a judge, you have to have practiced for at least 10 years, and then you have to have had experience and so on. And it's not until recently that we've started seeing large numbers of Indigenous and invisible minority people coming into the profession. And it's happening now, and I'm absolutely delighted about that. And I think things will change rapidly.
I wonder, though... Kim Campbell, who's former Prime Minister, who is your friend, she chairs the committee that advises on appointees to the courts. Mm-hmm. She said that there wasn't, the last time around when Sheila Martin was appointed, there wasn't an Indigenous judge in the pool that qualified. Should the rules be bent so that you can get somebody on the court more quickly, that is, as we say, more reflective of the country?
Well, I don't know. I'm not prepared to give an opinion on that. I think
that sounds the way you used to talk when you were still Chief Justice.
Well, I still talk like that. I haven't changed completely. But, you know, I think we shouldn't. I wasn't part of that process.
Right.
And there's a lot of factors that go into it. I mean, I think we don't know who applied. So just bending, changing the rules is not necessarily. There may have been Indigenous people who could have applied but didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see. I will say this. I'd like to see a little more flexibility. While I'm a full supporter of bilingual judges, French and English, on the Supreme Court of Canada, given the cases, but we really need to have a conversation about if an Indigenous person has two Canadian languages, their Indigenous language, and either French or English, should they, just because they haven't learned the other French or English, depending on the case, language, should they not be considered? I would like to see a little more flexibility on that. There was an article when Harry Laforme, who was an Indigenous judge on the Court of Appeal, very fine judge in Ontario, retired, and he gave an interview, and I think he suggested that he might have applied for the Supreme Court, but that he didn't feel he had enough French. So that kind of hurt me a bit. Here's a Canadian, a great judge, already has two good, perfectly good Canadian languages, but, you know, and felt he shouldn't apply. I'd like to see a little more conversation around that, but as I say, I'm a full supporter of bilingualism. But when I went on the Supreme Court of Canada, I had some French. I'd worked hard at it, but it took me a year or a year and a half to 2 years to get up to speed. And I think we could talk about that a little bit more. And when you're working in French, as I was, and English at the Supreme Court of Canada, it becomes much easier to learn it and pick it up in a real practical way.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kind of conversations we could have.
However flawed, there are maybe some flaws in the judicial appointment process in Canada, I'm assuming you must feel better about the way it happens here than in Washington,
yeah,
having seen what's gone on there in the most recent, yeah, Supreme Court appointments.
Well, yes, I think we've avoided politicizing the appointment process, and I hope we always will. I think that we don't want a court that's a shadow legislative body or shadow parliament where it's known that certain people on the court may feel it necessary to vote in certain ways on certain issues, mm-hmm, depending on political affiliation or background. I'm not saying that American judges can't assert and don't assert their independence, sometimes going against the people who appointed them. But to the extent that there is this perception of politicization, it really does perhaps undermine people's confidence in the judiciary and whether they can get, you know, an impartial hearing on their particular issue or whether they're going to get a more politically slanted thing. So I'm glad we've avoided that in Canada, and I hope we always will.
Okay, well, it's your turn now, everyone out there, and I'm betting there's a lot of lawyers in this room, so no one is allowed to plead any cases. We'll have short questions, and that way we can get as many in as possible. So if you please put your hands up, I'll try to get to as many as we can over here. Oh dear. He just said that he was in law school when Beverly McLaughlin was teaching, yes?
You didn't actually teach me evidence. I wish you had. A friend of mine took evidence from you. He said that he thought that you were a bit timid. You know, maybe not as self-confident as you obviously were when you faced down Harvard.
Absolutely.
I just got to repeat it for the sake of the tapes. He was saying that his friend took evidence with Beverly McLaughlin in law school, and she struck him as a bit timid and not much confidence. So he was asking whether there had been a bit of a growth curve over time.
I don't think I was ever timid, but I certainly struggled with self-confidence in the early parts of my career, and I was a bit of a perfectionist and always felt I was falling short. And as I discuss in the book, it was during my time at law school when I also toward the end had a child and became a parent, and I realized that my idea that I could somehow do everything perfectly was absolutely crazy. And then I came to peace with myself and I said, that's okay. I'll just do my best and move on. And I kind of changed my philosophy about myself and how I approached my work in the late 70s, during this time you're talking about. And it really, really helped me as a judge, because judges get a lot of cases and they come one after the other. And if you and you have to make the decisions, and you have to make them in a timely way, and if you get too fixated on absolute perfection, you will not be able to be a good judge. Similarly, if you look back all the time and saying, "Did I write that the way I wanted, or did I decide that the way I should have?" You will paralyze yourself. And this philosophy that I finally my growth curve. That led me to this change in the late 70s was really, I think, the making of me. I could go on, and I just decided I will not be. I know I can't be perfect. I will do the best I can, whether it's at parenting or deciding cases or teaching or whatever, and then I will move on. And That was a really important moment in my life, and I thank you for asking that question.
Can you put your hands up again? Okay, there's a gentleman over there, and then I'll come to you next. Go ahead. Oh, sorry, I can't see too well with the lights.
Oh.
Well, thank you for that. That is a beautiful story, and I will treasure that. But I have to say, I've been blessed in both my husbands, but Rory was the person who got me into law, who supported me all the time, and he used to say, when I was a judge here in British Columbia, he would say, "You're going to be on the Supreme Court of Canada," and I just laughed. I mean, I thought it was so absurd. And then, eight or 9 months after he died, I was appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada. He had so much faith in me, and he supported me throughout my career, and I could never have done it without him. And I have to say, my second husband, Frank McCardle, whom some of you may have met, is equally supportive. So I've been very, very fortunate in that. But thank you for sharing that story.
And just so the story's on the tape, the questioner met Beverly McLaughlin's first husband at the UBC farm.
I worked
with him at the farm, and he proudly declared that his wife was a lawyer.
Can I ask your name? Okay, good. Thank you. Congratulations.
Oh,
wonderful.
That's great. All right, as I promised, I'm going up here.
I
right cocktail of medication. And my question is, I know there's a whole lot of people who suffer from depression. How do you be a depressed lawyer and practice?
Well, I would. Okay, just let me.
Anywhere across the country that people like me, lawyers, can get support.
All right.
I can't practice anymore. It's been way too long. But
okay.
I guess I wanted to raise the issue of mental.
It's an important issue. Yeah. So the questioner is asking, she said she herself has suffered from depression, bipolar disorder, and has struggled with that and not been able to practice. And she wonders, how are you able to practice as a lawyer with depression, or is the issue of depression and mental illness being addressed properly in the profession?
Well, I think mental health issues are so huge in our justice system, in our society, and if you deal in the criminal law side, you see it all the time, and just generally. And of course, if you're suffering from mental illness, be it depression, bipolar, whatever, you can't do whatever you're trying to do, whether it's law or whatever. You can't. You're ill, and you need help. And I've spoken a lot about mental health and about the need for more attention and more treatment and more early diagnosis. Shortage of psychiatrists we have in this country and in other countries too. It is a big problem, and we need to do more to address it publicly. Through our health system and in our professions. I don't know. I don't know what the Canadian Bar Association is doing, but I'm all in favor of support, professional support, organizations. When I was Chief Justice, we had through the Judicial Council set up absolutely confidential. Counseling or services, talking services, consultation, so that if a judge was feeling depressed or felt whatever the problem might be, sometimes there were addiction problems, sometimes mental health problems, whatever, that person could phone in and or contact and would be put in touch with a group of professionals, maybe another judge. And I can tell you, this is totally confidential, because I would get the figures about how many people had availed themselves of it. I never heard a name. Never heard a name in all my time on the bench. So no one knew. It was totally confidential. But I was told by people who were administering the scheme that this really had helped a lot of people. So support things like that that we can develop or apply within our profession too. And it could be, I think, of great assistance to helping people get the help they need it when they need it.
And I just will note very quickly that things have changed quite a bit since the days. Some years ago, Gerald Ledain was on the Supreme Court of Canada and suffered from depression and was made to leave the court. That I don't think anything like that would happen today. He would be getting the help he needs. So who's next? Someone, anyone, hands up there. Go ahead.
I recently learned that you consulted with the King of Bhutan about constitutional...
I don't think it ever happened. Sorry. I don't know the King of Bhutan.
Sorry, just for the tape again, you're asking about her consulting with the King of Bhutan, which apparently did not happen.
No.
Okay. All right.
I am on the court in Hong Kong, on the Hong Kong Court of Final Appeal. And I'm going to... I was named there this year, and I'm going to be sworn in and do a four-week sitting commencing November 21st or 22nd of this year. So I'm going out there to sit on the court. Under the 1997 handover agreement, as you may know, the court is guaranteed in its traditional British-style form, independence and all of that. As part of that arrangement, the agreement was made that there always be an external judge on that court. And so mainly these have been filled by British people, but I've been asked to do that, so I'm very honored to do that. So
interesting time to be presiding over cases in Hong Kong. Now, I'm sure, I know there are lots of lawyers in here, but maybe there are others who don't understand that you didn't, well, you may have chosen to retire at 75, but the fact was under the legislation you had to retire at 75. That didn't mean you were done.
No. Well, somebody said to me, they were of a certain age, but they said the best line that they thought the best line in the book was, I say, to retire, quote unquote, is a transitive verb. You retire from something to something else.
I think we have time for one or two more questions over here.
Madam Justice McLaughlin, I really enjoyed your first novel, Full Disclosure. Mm-hmm.
Questioner is asking what I have to do this for the tape.
I'm sorry.
I apologize.
My apologies.
Questioner is asking whether that she said she really enjoyed your first novel. I'll give it a plug. Full disclosure. Do you have another one in the works?
Yes.
Any more? Any details? You told me a little more backstage.
Well, it's going to be a sequel to the first one. I haven't got very far into it yet, but it will come.
And I think we have time for one more. Someone, here, sir.
Yes, I'm curious if you've had any conversations with any of the women justices of the U.S. Supreme Court, and particularly Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yes, all of them.
Hang on.
Yeah, okay, where you go.
I want to hear this answer. Had any conversations with women on the U.S. Supreme Court, especially notorious Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
Right. Well, I've known all of the women on the Supreme Court, and I knew Sandra Day O'Connor, who was the first woman on the court, and she's a wonderful lady in a lot of ways, which I describe in the book. When I became Chief Justice, I initiated an exchange once every 3 years between our courts so that they'd send a delegation to Canada. The first one was Chief Justice Rehnquist and Sandra Day O'Connor and Justice Kennedy. And then we would send a delegation 3 years later down to Washington. And in the course of that, I got to know Ruth Bader Ginsburg quite well, and her husband, and also Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan. We've had some great conversations and interesting times.
Want to share any of that?
Well, mostly we talk boring things like law, you know. But, you know, we don't really get into... sometimes we would, but mainly we would talk about what it's like to be a judge and procedural matters and how we go about making your decisions. We're all doing the same kind of work, and there's a real commonality. And I found it was very helpful to not just be a judge on the Supreme Court of Canada, but to occasionally contact judges from other courts and to have friendships and conversations. It helps you get out of your own little bubble and exchange ideas. It's also great friends with Brenda Hale, who is the president of the Supreme Court and is doing such a great job in the United Kingdom. So I'm happy to say there's lots of great female judges, more and more around the world.
Seems like a good place to end. Just to make sure you know, there are copies of this wonderful book for sale in the lobby, and to Chief Justice, former Chief Justice, I don't know, notorious Beverly McLaughlin will be upstairs signing them for you. And if you have mobility problems, see someone in the front of house staff, and they can make sure your book get signed. All I can say is thank you so much. It's just been a lovely conversation.
Thank you.
Again.
Thank you.
And I hope we get to do it
again.
It. Thank you.
You've been listening to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers Fest. You can find Beverly McLaughlin's Truth Be Told wherever books or audiobooks are sold. To hear more events like this one, please visit our website at www.writersfest.bc.ca.